Today we are daring to tackle the rather provocative question of whether or not Jesus was a racist. And of course, we're using the term racist in the 21st century sense, which is a concept that did not exactly exist in the same way 2,000 years ago. So as we noticed in the first of this series, a better question to ask would be, how did Jesus treat others? Other races, yes, but also other age groups, other cultures, other genders, and also people from other religions. The term tribalism is best used to describe the fear of, the mistrust of, the discrimination towards, and the unease around those who are what we would consider others, other genders and other people who are different from our community, from our race, from our group, our denomination even. And that fear and mistrust automatically, subconsciously, naturally leads us to prefer people who are like us, because we sense that those who are different from us might pose a threat, either a physical threat or a threat in some way to our unity, our solidarity, our identity. And so in the religious sense, we might be convinced of the need to protect ourselves from what we perceive to be spiritual pollution from other beliefs. And that's why even those who believe almost everything that we do, but disagree on a few relatively minor matters, may still view us as heretics or enemies. Why else would the Christian church throughout history have killed thousands and thousands of fellow Christians who accepted 90% of the same doctrinal creeds as everyone else, but perhaps were Unitarian, for example, and thus rejected the contrived and self-contradictory doctrine of the Trinity, or who disagreed with infant baptism, but agreed on every other doctrine because they believed that a person had to make a conscious decision and had to be old enough to make that personal decision to repent and ask for forgiveness before baptism. So how did Jesus relate to those who were different? Now, this is really important because if Jesus is the model for how we ought to think and behave, then clearly, naturally, how he treated others, how he viewed and behaved around those who were different, even different religiously, should be a model for how we treat other people. After all, is it not the case that a true Christian is not necessarily one who has arrived at a particular set of doctrines or has bought into a particular statement of beliefs? A true Christian is simply a disciple, one who learns from and follows Jesus as Lord and Master. Is that not the case? So what was Jesus' legacy of either inclusion or exclusion? Acceptance of those who were different from him or rejection of the same? Well, I can put your mind at rest with a title like this because these are questions that are very, very easy to answer. We can say with certainty from the gospel accounts that Jesus was not an exclusionary, Jews only, us against the rest of the world, Old Testament rabbi, prophet, and Messiah. He was a rabbi, prophet, and Messiah to bring fulfillment to the hopes and dreams of especially those, regardless of their race, gender, culture, of those who were rejected, outcast, and subjugated by society and religion. Spiritual leaders throughout the ages have asserted that Jesus was not just the example and advocate for Christians, but for everyone. Mahatma Gandhi, a Hindu, once said, quote, "Jesus gave humanity the magnificent purpose and the single objective towards which we all ought to aspire." And he's referring to the message of Jesus that the greatest commandment is to love. Love God and love your neighbor. And that is that, and when asked, who are your neighbors? He said, everyone. Gandhi said, "I believe that he, Jesus, belongs not solely to Christianity, but to the entire world, to all lands and all races." In his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, biblical scholar Marcus Borg writes, "One of the hallmarks of Jesus' teaching was his pointed attacks on the purity system." What's that got to do with inclusion or exclusion? Well, this was the dominant theme in the Jewish social world during that time, and it was focused on creating a world with sharp social divisions and boundaries between pure and impure, between righteous and sinner, between whole and not whole, male and female, between rich and poor, and especially between Jew and Gentile. And Jesus, says Borg, deliberately replaced the core value of purity with compassion. Jesus' radical compassion was notably evident in his habitual participation in an open and inclusive table. Sharing a meal with someone in those days signified mutual acceptance. Jesus ate with the outcasts, with the downtrodden, and anyone who was considered impure. You know, if the ministry of Jesus lasted approximately 3 years, we have a very tiny slice in the Gospels of what happened during those 3 years. So there's not been any attempt in the Gospels to try to record everything that Jesus did. In one passage it even states, "And Jesus did many, many more things than these, and if it were all recorded, the books of the world wouldn't be able to hold them." So whatever is in there, whatever stories are relayed, are things that the author agreed were extremely significant, relevant, and important. So the fact that it even records that he had dinner with a tax collector, who cares? He was hungry, he ate. No big deal. But it was a big deal. It was a huge deal because of what he was doing that was in contrast to and in rejection of his society. Through his actions, Jesus demonstrated that all people are welcome at the table of God's kingdom, and for Jesus, all meant all. Jesus epitomized the very concept of welcoming the unwelcomed and opening the way for all to be treated with a sense of respect and equality and dignity that we would even find rather radical in our time and standards. You will recall his last act on the cross was to ask for forgiveness for those who had rejected him and for those who were about to take his life. Not rejection, not retaliation towards those people, but forgiveness and acceptance. And just prior to that event, he had granted entrance into the life of the kingdom the criminal on the cross next to him, because the criminal exhibited sincere sorrow and accepted full responsibility for his actions. Jesus famously ate with tax collectors. These were viewed in general as Jewish traitors and extortioners, because they usually were. He kept close company with women who had lived formerly or presently lives that would have been considered scandalous and impure. Remember, the whole idea of pollution, morally, spiritually, or impurity. The whole idea was like a sickness, like a virus. If you got close to those people, if you hung out with tax collectors, you would begin to be polluted by their values, their morality, immorality. If you associated with prostitutes or women who were not in today's sense of prostitutes, but women who simply had no other means of an income to raise perhaps a family on their own, or whatever the reason was, but you would be polluted. You would be tainted. You would catch their moral degradation. And, of course, there was a great belief in demonology and the idea that spirit within the person wasn't just a moral issue, but a spiritual issue, and you could catch that demonic presence or that demonic influence. Jesus touched the untouchable, the lepers. He took time to relate to children that others were quick to dismiss and move on. He taught that true religion was to give food to the hungry. Nobody else was saying that. That sounds like what we would call social Christianity or social justice. True religion is to give food to the hungry? That's separate from religion, isn't it? But Jesus was saying no, because true spirituality is about connecting with people, but not just people like you, not just the ones that are in your tribe or in your church or in your denomination or in your race. What makes them approachable for Jesus is that they had a need, and he had the ability to meet it. If someone is hungry and you have food and can give it to them, what does it matter what church they go to or none, or whether or not they are young or old, or of your race or some other race? It seems the only people Jesus didn't tolerate were those who preyed on the vulnerable, those who exploited the weak and dependent, along with especially abusive and controlling religion. Now, one example in particular illustrates the radical inclusion of Jesus towards not just someone from a different culture or a different religious worldview, but towards an actual enemy of his people. And we can never get fully the sense of what this was like, because we don't have this kind of oppressive military presence that controls our daily life. This incident is found in Matthew 8, 5 to 13. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home, paralyzed and suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Will I come and heal him? Is that what you want me to do?" And the centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, for I myself am a man under authority, and I say to one man, do this, and he does it, and I say to another, go, and he goes, and to that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." And when Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, "Truly I tell you, I have not found this kind of faith in all Israel. I say to you followers, that many will come from the east and from the west, that is from the Gentile nations, and I will take their place with them when we feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom, the Jews themselves, will often be thrown outside into darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, because they have rejected me." And Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, let it be done as you wish, as you believed it would." And his servant was healed at that very hour. Now, before we look at this in a little more detail, I want you to recognize that this is one of those instances that remind us of something very important about the Gospels. That the gospel stories were told and retold long before they were written into the books that we now call Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. The authors were not eyewitnesses to the events. First and foremost, they were all written in Greek. Greeks were not in Palestine following Jesus, in Judea, in Galilee. The authors were not eyewitnesses, but certain stories and certain traditions created from actual events were memorialized through the years and recorded in the Gospels. And so we can't expect them to be identical when different Gospels tell the same stories, because slightly different variations of those traditions developed. And so they wrote what they remembered or what they had heard. In the retelling of this story, we can even see authors challenge or sometimes correct earlier authors. So Mark wrote first, and so sometimes Luke will change what Matthew or Mark wrote. Matthew might change something Mark wrote. In Matthew's gospel, the second one to be written, the centurion approached Jesus, as we just read, and asked for help. But in the later version of the same story, told by Luke's author, there is no way that a high-ranking Roman officer would approach a Jewish rabbi for help, because it's a public event and it would be something that wouldn't be done. It is more likely correct to say, as Luke does in his account, that the centurion, quote, sent elders of the Jews to go talk to Jesus, to ask him to come to the house or to heal from a distance. Regardless, this passage is primarily a condemnation of the unbelieving Jews, of the quarreling Jews, of those who had lost the spiritual heart of their religion, and an extending of all the gifts and grace of God to those outside of the house of Israel, outside of what would normally be God's grace specifically to Israel. But it also reminds us of the mission, the central mission of Jesus was to prepare the hearts of the people for the kingdom of God. And one of the ways that the scriptures tells us that Jesus was to do this was by signs and wonders, to draw heaven down to earth, to make people feel like God was coming near. And healings were by far the most common of the signs attributed to Jesus. Not for the purpose of proving that he could do magic, that he was a god, but as a dramatic precursor and demonstration of the power of the kingdom about to burst forth into the world. But it's no mistake that the good news of what God could do on earth, as it is in heaven, through Jesus, is for anyone and everyone who will listen and believe, including women, prostitutes, tax collectors, young and old, and even the enemies of Israel, the Romans. Judea was a province under the direct control of Rome starting in about the year 6 AD. Prior to that occupation, Rome had kept an arm's length influence in the area through Rome-appointed overseers, including Herod, who was the first to be designated as king of the Jews under the control of Rome. And I'm sure there were occasions when individual Roman soldiers befriended and were trusted by individual Jews or small groups of either. But let's never forget, Rome wanted peace, stability, and prosperity in the region. They didn't conquer people for the sake of conquering. They conquered them for the sake of taxation. And so they needed stability. They needed peace, trade to exist and to increase the education of their subjects, to increase wealth, to increase profits and taxes. And Jews, unfortunately, in the eyes of the Romans, were a constant potential enemy of stability in Rome. And it was up to the governor and Roman military forces to maintain what was, for the Jews, a Gentile, pagan measure of law and order. Now, what's paganism got to do with any of this? Well, in the Greco-Roman world, gods were everywhere. In temples, in homes, in the Senate, on the battlefield, gods were inseparable from everyday life. And gods were involved in economics, in politics, in war, in agriculture, in prosperity, and of course in things like fertility and death. So when a member of one's family or household was gravely ill, as the centurion's servant was, naturally the gods were involved, either causing the sickness or involved in healing and making them better. But it would have been outrageous for a Roman centurion to ask a Jewish rabbi to plead to the Jewish God for healing instead of his own national and household divinities. And for a Jewish rabbi to accept and respond to that request would have been equally unthinkable. So the story is almost unbelievable that a Roman centurion would ask a Jewish rabbi to pray to his God when he had his own gods. And there were gods of healing specifically for this purpose within the Roman pantheon. And a centurion was not an average Roman soldier. They commanded 100 soldiers, that's why they're called centurions. And they themselves were all soldiers who had risen from the lowest ranks of the military. And they had gained this position with a lot of privileges because of their absolute devotion to the Roman army, to the Roman state, and to the whole ideal of Roman military obedience to hierarchy. As far as the centurion was concerned, there's no reason to believe that he knew Jesus at all, but he must have heard that Jesus was a healer. And he didn't care which God would do the healing. He was simply crying out to end the suffering of his servant. And by responding to the centurion, Jesus wasn't following orders of a Roman soldier. So I don't want you to think that Jesus was sort of under orders here, being commanded by an occupying soldier to come and do something against his will. Jesus was very happy to reach out his love and healing powers to someone who wasn't even a Jew, someone who wasn't even a friend to his people, someone who clearly had their own gods. He was simply responding to a measure of trust and confidence from a human being who had a need that he could fulfill. What makes this account even more shocking is that the Greek word used for servant, pais, at P-A-I-S, is very commonly used for child or slave, or specifically child slave or boy lover. Homosexual relations between two consenting adults were frowned upon in the Roman army. Romans were very domineering and what we might call macho in personality. And so it was quite unacceptable, or rather it was quite acceptable, for an officer such as a centurion to have a subservient young boy lover. It was an indicator of the soldier's virility and masculinity in that culture. And we can't state categorically that Jesus healed the young lover of a centurion, but we also can't rule out the possibility. And based upon what we know of Jesus, I don't think he's likely to have refused a request from someone who looked to him in faith just because that person had not yet learned all the rules and restrictions of the Jewish religion. Either way, Jesus is entering comfortably into the world of others, into the world of the enemy, and not just accepting them into the kingdom of God, but demonstrating that those who think they stand, those are the ones actually about to fall. It's a lesson in humility versus the pride of those who are descendants of Abraham. Was Jesus a racist? Absolutely not. Did Jesus display tribalism? Absolutely not. Jesus is the ultimate model for anti-tribalism. He wasn't just against it, he defied it and spoke out against it often and suffered rejection and shame because of his opposition to this us against them thinking. Jews against Gentile. But let's not pick on the Jews. This happens to all groups of people. Catholics against Protestants. Protestants against Catholics. Baptists against Methodists. It's part of our human nature. And it has nothing to do with religion or spirituality. It goes back to what I said in the beginning. It's everything to do with our discomfort of people who are not our tribe, who are not like us. And it's something we have to consciously fight against, because if we don't, we naturally clump into us and everyone else is them. The bottom line is this: Jesus had no fear of others. Why? Because he had the ability to understand and to sympathize with others, all others. He could relate to the suffering of others. He could sense the needs of others and have the courage to respond to those needs, no matter what the personal cost. He could enter into the experience of others for a brief moment to look beyond the immediate skin color, origin, their immediate behavior or actions, and see a person struggling to do their best and to sincerely live a worthwhile life, and yes, even when at times that life was a sinful life, that person still had value to Jesus. And in the final analysis, our job is to emulate Jesus. John 10, 27 to 28 says of Jesus, "My sheep hear my voice, I know them, and they follow me." Do as Jesus did. Let the law of love extend to all others, to those beyond the laws of rituals and commandments, to those beyond our beliefs and ideologies, and to those both inside and outside our personal tribe, whatever that may be.